Under the skin, 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 under the skin.
Hello and welcome to Under the Scales. Tom Marshall, your host here. As you know, Under the Scales is part of a growing community of podcasts and live events and other video content. Please check it out at OsirisPod.com or at OsirisPod on Twitter and Instagram. Speaking of Osiris, we've been doing a couple of commentary shows surrounding fish webcasts. Hashtag Couch Report. The next one of those is from the Saturday Atlanta show on August 4th. That's scheduled for 7 p.m. Eastern time. We also have some cool stuff planned for Curveball. Much of the Osiris family of podcasters will be in attendance, so we're planning some great live events. Stay tuned to our Twitter at OsirisPod or check out our news area on our newly redesigned OsirisPod.com page. I'm pleased to announce that there's now an Under the Scales YouTube channel. Soon, all of the podcasts will be available for those of you who listen to music and podcasts on YouTube, thanks to the hard work of our colleague, Alan Barry. Thanks, Alan. Many of our Osiris family have podcasts and content available on YouTube. Check out youtube.com/osirismedia to find all these, including the new Under the Scales channel. That's youtube.com/osirismedia. Now I want to tell you about Masterclass. Imagine learning new recipes from Gordon Ramsay or photography tips from Annie Leibovitz. Now you can with Masterclass. Masterclass offers online classes taught by the best in the world. Each video class is shot with cinematic production quality and offers on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content you'll find only on Masterclass. You can choose lessons from classes taught by over 35 masters, including Shonda Rhimes on pitching an idea, Malcolm Gladwell on interviewing, Alice Waters on seasonal eating, and so many more. Plus, new classes are always being added. Whether you are pursuing your passion or developing your career, you'll find a masterclass for you. Masterclass has even been featured by the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and ESPN. For a limited time, Under the Scales listeners get a free 7-day trial at masterclass.com/scales. Learn from the best in the world at masterclass.com/scales. Thanks, Masterclass. Welcome to Under the Scales. This is Tom, your host, and the Under the Scales remote studio is as far from Princeton, New Jersey as it has ever been. I'm on the West Coast, and I just saw the first show of the two shows that Fish is doing at Lake Tahoe. And I have with me today a co-host, RJB, whom you all know from the Helping Friendly podcast. Hi, RJ.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Absolutely. Thanks for helping me with this tremendously difficult potentially guest, Brad Serling. How are you, Brad?
I hope I'm not too difficult.
we're not anticipating too much difficulty. And for those of you who do not know, Brad Serling is the founder of Nugs.net. And you guys interact with him whether you know it or not, and we're going to try to explain that to you. But first, RJ has an important thing to tell you.
Under the Scales is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts bringing you content, commentary, and live experiences. Check out OsirisPod.com. We're adding new awesome podcasts all the time.
That was extremely well done, and it's important because otherwise we get arrested immediately after this podcast if we broadcast it without that info. All right. Well, Brad, thank you for sitting through that silliness.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Really glad you drove down from a different part of the lake.
From the northwest corner.
Okay, cool. Very cool. So you're a Californian, so it's not that far for you to come to a Lake Tahoe show.
Right. I live in San Francisco. This is now actually 20 years I live in California.
Okay, wow.
Actually moved out to California the night that Fish played the Greek in LA, and then that Vegas run.
That did it for you.
That was my, well, no, I was planning, I planned the whole move from New York based on the Fish tour.
Like an insane person plan your move around Fish?
I absolutely did. So it's funny, it's coming up now on that when Fish is in Vegas for Halloween. It'll be the 20th anniversary of me moving to California.
Oh, wow, okay, got it. That's amazing. All right, well, Nugs.net powers livefish.com. Webcasts and just the live fish music that you get if you're a live fish user. Nugs.net was started in 1997 to help fans download music. Can you give us a little sort of background on how it was formed, how it came about?
Well, to talk just about the Nugs.net part, the idea for the name came to me flying back from the Great Went. And so it was that Monday after the Great Went, I got to my office in New York and went to our sysop guy and said, hey, can we register .net domains? And he's like, yeah, what do you want? I was like, how about Nugs.net? Boom, set it up. So it was August 97 that I registered Nugs.net as a name.
All right.
A key moment for me was 92, 93 when Jerry Garcia fell ill and canceled the fall tour. And I was living in London at the time. The like spring 93, the Dead came back. They had a bunch of new songs. And I'm in the University of London Library, and I was using their internet connection to grab samples of the new songs.
Hmm.
I was dying here. So there was this ftp.gdead.berkeley.edu. It was some dude at UC Berkeley who had an FTP site that, you know, there was like tour date information, ticket information, cover art, photos. And then around 93, this guy started posting, it was just fans, not just one dude, started posting little AU files, which was like a Unix audio format. And so I was sitting in London listening to Lazy River Road or whatever the new songs were at the time. And I was like, oh, this is amazing that I'm in London and I'm hearing what the Dead played. It wasn't last night. It was like maybe like two or three nights before. But still, like, something clicked in my head. Like,
they were audience tapes, probably, right?
They were audience tapes.
Yes.
But it's still the concept that I am completely around the globe.
Yeah.
I was pissed off that I was missing the, you know, like, I didn't get to see the Dead before I went to London for the year because they canceled those shows. They canceled the field trip that was supposed to be in Eugene.
Right.
You know, this whole thing. So I had a lot of pent-up Grateful Dead energy and was just blown away that through the internet I was able to listen to a show that had just happened.
And
that,
like, this internet thing might turn into
something. And the funny thing was, it never occurred to me as a business. It was just like, oh, this is cool. This is the way that bands are going to communicate. It wasn't like, I was like, oh, I'm going to write a business plan and raise money and do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the farthest thing from my mind. You know, I had no idea what I was going to do.
That's often how the best businesses start. You're solving a problem for yourself.
Right. It was a very practical thing. So, you know, I was studying American foreign policy during the Cold War. Yeah. That clearly leads to a music industry career.
Right.
And, you know, when I was in England, I was studying like European history. So it was the farthest thing from my mind was turning this into a business. And, you know, the whole .com thing hadn't happened yet. But just fast forwarding a bit, I graduated, didn't know what I was going to do, thought I was going to go to law school, applied to a couple schools, and happened to see that it was like April 94, happened to see that Adam Curry, who was a VJ on MTV, the big haired VJ who did Headbangers Ball, who happens to be the Podfather, the guy who created the podcast as a format.
Wow.
So he had posted something. I was with a buddy who grew up in Woodstock and we were looking for information on Woodstock 94. So there was no Google. There was Yahoo barely existed. It was like a very basic directory. So we found through this Yahoo directory at Stanford, ikibonu.stanford.edu. I remember all the URLs. You used to have to type them into like command line Lynx browsers.
Yeah.
So, we happened to see Adam Curry quits MTV on air and starts company. That day, he had quit MTV on the air and posted a message on MTV.com that he had registered while he was a VJ and said, hey, I'm starting a new company looking for, you know, talented men and women. I sent him a business plan I'd just written in the, as an undergrad, I took a B school class and wrote this plan for like doing advertising on the internet. Got a C- or C+ on the project. The teacher said it would never work. Yeah, that was in spring of 94. So I sent that plan to Adam Curry. He said, when can you come to New York? I was like, well, I'm about to graduate and go on tour with the Dead. But, you know, we're swinging through Giant Stadium in August. Can I come in then? So, yeah, again, long story short, went and met with him. He hired me on the spot. I was there, the only Deadhead at Giant Stadium in like a suit and tie. Well, Adam was in ripped jeans and a t-shirt, but yeah, that was my first. So I ended up working for him. And Woodstock.com was actually the first thing I ever worked on in my professional career. So my first gig was working for Adam, who started a company called OnRamp. I built Woodstock.com. I built the first NFL.com. I built the first Grammy website. Did all this stuff. Wait, this is 94, 95. So right when that whole .com thing was starting, you know, the day Jerry died was the day Netscape went public. It was, which was never lost on me. It was a year later.
Wow.
It was like all these things happened that somehow were
guiding you toward this field in a way.
Yes. Yeah, so it was.
So you're a tech guy. You're a programmer.
Well, I was. I was a history major, like I said. But by going to work for Adam, I learned, it was trial by fire.
There were no tools. A tech guy.
Like he taught. He used to call himself the geek with the hammer. Like he was a cool dude, or fashioned himself as this cool guy, but was a total propeller head. In fact, we, you know, Christmas Day, we bought him a little propeller head beanie. I loved it. Like, so I learned from him how it's okay that you could be the CEO and founder of a company, be a total Dorcas Malorcas, and still like be a cool guy and do stuff in the music business.
There you go.
So my heart was in the music business, but I was building like Budweiser.com.
Gotcha.
But through Budweiser.com is really how NugsNet started, because Anheuser-Busch was paying us to run the Budweiser site. We would, they would send me around the country to like NASCAR events to do cybercasts. So that was in 95. So I would go around the country, and somehow miraculously, all of those NASCAR events perfectly aligned up with Fish Tour. So I could have Anheuser-Busch pay to fly me out to Denver or Portland or wherever. And then I could go see Fish at the Gorge and go see, you know, the Portland Meadows show. And like by that time it was 98, you know, and that's really the genesis of NugsNet, because I went to a bunch of those shows, left my tape deck on tour, and, you know, I registered Nugs.net as a separate domain in 97. So I had, to get back to your question, I had the wherewithal to do it because Anheuser-Busch was paying for the server space and the Akamai bandwidth.
Right.
And Adam, my boss at the time, was like, do whatever you want, just don't cost us more than, you know, we were using like 2% of the bandwidth.
What was available.
So the way it worked back then, you had to buy bandwidth in bulk if you were to do anything serious. So we bought, at the time, absurd amounts of bandwidth that was not being used.
And where were you buying it from back
Akamai.
Then?
Oh, same Akamai. Company where you, it's funny,
still
it's the same company.
Today?
And I've gone through every CDN there is, every content delivery network, yeah, because my Cinema Nowadays, which we can get to in a bit. So I you know, there's people who you know in the long run are going to be there, and they're going to be there tomorrow. And
right.
Akamai's one.
Akamai is still there.
So, in fact, if you're listening to anything on Livefish or watching any webcast, that's how it's being delivered. So
interesting.
Back then, we had all this bandwidth. I had all these tapes, and I thought I would come home from tour, and so many people wanted copies of the tapes. I said, there has to be a better way.
Yes, there's a better way to do this.
So, and this was actually going back to 94. In 94, I called up the Grateful Dead and said, can I put my tapes on a website? And the Dead were still touring at the time. Mm. They said, what's a website?
Right.
Do whatever you want, just don't rip us off.
Okay.
And then by 97, when I registered NugsNet as a separate domain, I started posting Fish tapes and Dead tapes. And at that time, Fish had a, you know, loosey-goosey taper policy.
Yes.
That said, you know, post your tapes. It was non-commercial,
right,
trading only. So I made it a point from the get-go that the site, Nugs.net, was completely non-commercial.
Right.
No banner ads, no clickbait, no, you know, it was no registration even. It was just, here's the show, here's the set list. You could download it or you could stream it.
Nice.
Which was kind of revolutionary to tell me you could stream it.
Right.
But it was really summer 98. So 97, I registered the site. It was mostly like my photos from shows. I put up a couple clips. Like New Year's 95, I had done like a little photo montage. I made it into an animated GIF to show the balloon drop.
Right.
And then I put up little tiny audio clips because you couldn't really put up. But by 97, 98, you could put up full shows. There was no bandwidth. People knew what to do with it.
Were the bands starting to take notice a little bit?
97, 98, I don't think so. So 98, I put up the entire summer tour.
Wow.
That was really the start of what I'm still doing today.
Okay.
So, and as far as I know, at the time, in summer 98, it was the first time that anyone, anywhere, had every night that a band had played.
Weren't those eventually coming out like on B2 at the
time? E-Tree,
yeah.
Yeah, that was happening around the same time.
Okay.
But I had one site. It was a lot easier to get, you know, because
you
just
point that one, you still have to do all kinds of conversions and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And these were MP3s. And of course, I had the DATs that they came. I had the lossless versions, but lossless wasn't really a thing then.
Right. And took
it
a lot
became
of
a thing, and we did, you know, so we started using Shorten before FLAC became popular. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
But that was a big deal to me once we actually started working with Fish and getting that going. Like the lossless part was a huge, which we can get to.
Yes, sure.
But so that's how NugsNet, the fan site, started, and it just kind of bubbled up. And it wasn't until 2000 that I kind of got a call from the same lawyer that represented Fish and the Dead. And it was at that point that they said, we either need to shut you down or go into business with you. So once again,
one B, please.
Right. So I did the same thing I did with to get the job with Adam Curry. I was still, I think by that point I'd already left Adam's company. And I went to Cinema Now, and I was founding CTO of Cinema
Just
Now.
Because I hadn't heard that name since the MTV days.
Yeah.
What happened to Adam? Did he become tremendously successful and do well in business?
Well, OnRamp, we rolled up with six other companies, went public in like around Thanksgiving, 96, tried to capture some of the dot-com magic. It did okay. It wasn't anything.
Okay.
But, and then he went off. He sold the company. I left to start Cinema Now. I think he moved to Austin. I don't know. But he was the podfather. He was the first guy to really popularize the whole podcast idea.
Cool.
And
Thanks, Adam. Awesome. Thanks for all your revolutionary work. If you're listening.
So, Brad, when did you first start seeing Phish? It sounded like you were a dead fan before discovering Phish. Were you like at early? It sounds like early '90s. You kind of discovered them.
So my first show was 10-190 at the Haunt in Ithaca. So I was a freshman at Cornell. I had first heard of Phish probably in, I don't know, maybe a year before. It was in 89. Because I remember I got an 89 tape. So a friend of mine who I would trade dead tapes, it's like, hey, I know you're into the Allman Brothers. This band from Vermont does this cover of Whipping Post. You should hear it. So he made me a tape. It was maybe from the front in 89 or something, of Phish, and it had Whipping Post on it. And I was like, this is awful. This is like, these guys can't sing. The guitar player is really good, but like, you know, it was a mess. And then it was like, I didn't know. And like all these weird, I was like, this is weird.
It's a hodgepodge of sound coming at me.
And these lyrics, what the, I just didn't get it. But you know,
that's a whole different topic.
So I knew, I'd heard of the band. And by the time I got to Cornell and, you know, I saw posters for Phish on the wall, and it was like 3 weeks into my freshman year, you know, my little circle of new Deadhead friends, including the dude who was sitting with me that day that I saw Adam Curry quit, you know, 4 years later. And so my friend from Woodstock, he went with me to the Haunt to see Phish. And I, you know, I remember going in there, and there was maybe 60 or 70 people there. There was a couple tapers, which I took as a good sign. I was like, well, I guess if people are committed to taping this band, you know, it's worth checking out. Made it through the first set. By the second set, when the strobe lights came on and the fog machine and they're jumping on the trampolines, I was like, I need to get out of here. I don't know what, I felt like everyone was in on a joke and I was the butt of the joke. Like there was like something going on that clearly they were so focused on, it was so well developed, but it was too opaque.
I didn't get it. Yeah, exactly.
It's not
the best way of winning new fans, right?
No,
Making them think that they didn't get the inside joke.
Right. So
still happens today, right?
Still happens today, but it's at least more accessible.
Yeah.
So I left halfway through my first two Phish shows, actually. So it was October 90, and then they came back Valentine's Day 91 to the State Theater. And I thought it was interesting that they had, within a span of a couple months, jumped from a tiny bar, the Haunt, to the State Theater.
Right.
Now, granted, the State Theater was only a third full, but again, there were even more tapers.
Right, and it has the word theater, which matters.
Yeah, and it's a nice place. It's a famous show. It's that show where Trey tossed the keys into the crowd
and gave away the van.
Yeah. So, and there's a video of it because the local public TV station in Ithaca, or maybe it was the Cornell station, like shot. So there's some video, whatever. So that was my second show. And the third show was 9/26/91 in the State.
Okay.
And again, even bigger crowd. That time it was sold out. I remember people.
Wow.
People were standing outside in the Ithaca Commons with their finger in the air. I was like,
wow.
So in a year, like almost to the date, because it was 10-190 and then 9/26/91.
Right.
Within the span of a year, I saw the ascent that the band was making in terms of popularity. And by that point, I had listened to a lot more tapes than any of the material, but I still thought it was fucking weird, but at least, you know, I got it. I was like, okay. Right. By 92, I was fully on board. And by, you know, I would say by the end of 92, I was not so much traveling to see them that much because all of my money was going into traveling and taping the dead.
Right.
So like how much disposable income do you have as a college kid?
Right.
So I would see Phish when I could, but I was still just seeing as many dead shows as I could because I knew that was going to end. Felt like Phish is going to be here for a while and take my time with that. I didn't so much think that Jerry was going to drop dead, but it was clear that the end was near because like how much longer could it was like break busting apart at the seams.
Yep.
So I wanted to see them as many times as I could,
right,
knowing that was a special moment in the, you know, history of the world, and when will something like this ever happen again?
Exactly.
I don't know why. Just like that's what dawned on me on my first dead show in '88. It was like, and it was the kind of corny, cheesy moment. Like, hey, they're playing Truckin' at the Spectrum, and what a long, strange trip it's been. The lights come up in the crowd. I was like, oh my god! Like this is a thing. This is like a piece of American, you know, history here, and like the way it came out of the counterculture, the acid test, and everything about it, and the way they embraced technology and were so forward thinking what they do. I immediately latched onto that. And I saw that Phish was coming from the same mindset.
I think so.
But from a totally different musical some similarities in the reefs, but
yeah, of course.
But it was like,
of course,
that was the only time I'd seen anything like that other than the dead was right. the fish
right.
at the time.
Interesting.
So that's that was my.
And you were sort of in the fish spotlight in terms of touring, being at Cornell, right? There's ample places for you to see them.
Well, the same for Fish and the Dead. I mean, I could see Jerry 135 times before he died because being in New York, and I grew up in right. Philly, like you could see this Four Nights at the Spectrum, Nine Nights at the Garden, yeah. Nine Nights at the Boston Garden.
Exactly.
You could really rack up the tapes and the shows. And
right.
Same with Fish. Being yep. in Ithaca, New York, I mean, it was yeah. like... You can go up. I actually didn't travel to Burlington to see them for what?
Fish Central, Ithaca. Well, actually.
Yeah. Ithaca was right there.
Watkins Glen is right. like going back to your old.
My buddy just texted me this morning. I'm going to go sailing on Lake Cayuga during
Lent. Yeah. We're going to go pontooning on Lake Seneca.
Yeah. I'm partial to Cayuga.
Yeah, so I know. That's the neighboring Finger Lake. So,
Binghamton, saw a lot of Binghamton shows, Syracuse.
So, Brad, let's talk about a little bit, just keeping on the fish theme. What do you find that now that you're working with fish in such an interesting way? And I'm sure that when they called you and said, we're either going to, you know, put you out of business or work with you, that was probably pretty cool to start figuring out how to work with them. And that's been a long time, right?
That was in June of 2000 or April 2000.
So do you think, just from my perspective as a fish fan, what do you think people, fish fans, generally understand and don't understand about the way that Nugs, Ned, and Fish work together? Or are there common misconceptions that you run into from fish fans that
in a way they don't need to know much about Nugs.net, yeah. right? Because they have that live fish interface.
Right. You don't need to know how the sausage is made. And there's sort of induced confusion. You know, it's... We set out from the get-go that live fish was its own thing.
Yeah.
Nugsnet was the name, like at the time I signed the deal with Fish,
yeah.
I created Nugsnet Enterprises as an LLC. So it became, I had Nugsnet, the fan site,
yeah.
but I, you know, created a company called Nugsnet to do the fish thing. And we started live fish officially on, you know, New Year's 2002.
Right.
I think we launched it 12/20/02 with like a free download of the first last show ever, that Shoreline show.
Mm-hmm.
But it, the idea was
the first last show ever.
Live Fish was its own entity, and it was very important to the band that it was its own thing. But it was also very important to the band that Nugsnet remain as a free site. And Trey, in particular, was like, "You need to keep this thing going as it is. Don't take your fish audience tapes off of Nugsnet just because you're going into business with us."
Right.
It's like that'll send totally the wrong message.
Yeah.
At the same time, they were like, we don't want, you know, they clearly saw the potential of the business that Nugsnet now is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had initially thought about doing like doing it as a joint venture that would go out to these other bands. And there's a little backstory about that as well. But, you know, when it came down to it, the band didn't want to be beholden to other bands and didn't want to run a business or have ownership in a business that was doing String Cheese and Umphreys and nothing against those bands. It was just... Fish is fish. And the yes. business of fish is fish. It always has been fish.
Right.
They're fiercely independent.
Yep.
And, you know, that's why it works. And that's why they liked me and not some cookie cutter Warner Brothers, AOL. You know, they were on Elektra at the time. Elektra would have loved for them to bubble up into the AOL Time Warner infrastructure
yes.
and be on the same system, AOL right. music that Madonna was on. You know, like,
yeah.
that's not going to work for fish.
No.
So that's why they wanted to do the deal with me. Oh, but cool. it was important to, you know, to keep fish and keep Nugsnet. So that's how... Over the years, we're now almost 20 years later, Nugs.net exists as a company. Live Fish is a standalone brand powered by Nugs.net. So that's how it works. Same with, and we did the same with Metallica. Metallica is its own thing, Live mm-hmm. Metallica. It's run by Nugsnet, but you're interacting with Metallica. Everything else we do, even the huge names like Springsteen, that's on Nugs.net, and we have a part of, we're built into the Springsteen site, but that's more Nugsnet than Fish. Like Fish is powered by Nugsnet, but you're interacting with Fish. Credit card is charged Live Fish. There's a Live Fish app. And frankly, how many other bands can sustain that? A subscription business, a pay-per-view business, a standalone download and CD business just for one band.
Right.
And that was a kind of a watershed moment of 6 months after launching livefish.com. There was this article in the Times about Live Fish, how the band had, you know, the band, and this was before iTunes existed as a store. The band Fish, which most people hadn't even heard of at that point,
had their own
download store yeah. where you could buy a recording of the night before.
And, pretty intense.
And it had, you know, it was
that probably helped your business, like, you know, well, of course, relationships with Springsteen and stuff happened after that, right?
Well, what was interesting, when before we launched Live Fish, it was like 2000 or 2001. And this was with, you know, it was, I have to credit Palooska and Colton. So it was their foresight, their forward thinking, and frankly, their trust in me. I was a huge fan, but obviously had my shit together. I had a professional career being the CTO of a, you know, company licensing for the major studios. So I knew how the business worked. I knew how the technology worked.
Yeah.
But they had the vision of what this should be. And yeah. So they brought me to this meeting with Warner Brothers to get approval, basically, because they were signed to a major label at the time. And this was in, I guess, probably 2001 at this point. So we needed their okay or their blessing to do this, because they were doing the deal with me separate from their record deal, which was unheard of at the time. And so I went through this whole pitch of what Nugsnet was, what I was going to do for Fish, and you know, Palooska was there, Colton was there, Burke Goldstein was there, all the usual cast of characters, the attorneys, and this EVP of whatever at Warner Brothers. Instead of saying yes or no to Nugsnet for Fish, he said, can you build us a Nugsnet for Metallica? So that's how, so before we'd even launched Live Fish, Metallica was already, that's the first thing the label thought of, because they were trying to get out from under the Napster debacle.
Now, is there an interest, now, okay, so they don't have as much, at least to me, I could be completely wrong, but they don't have as much diversity in their live show to warrant the demand that Fish has for their live stuff. So you're talking about different content for Metallica, including all their albums.
Well, with Metallica, it was, we started with them, we didn't start until 2004, and we had that meeting with the label in 2001. I couldn't figure out why between 2001 and 2004 we couldn't get it off the ground. And it wasn't until they invited me to the premiere of Some Kind of Monster that I, you know, was in the theater, saw, remember that movie they made where they showed the band in therapy? Then I was like, oh, they didn't know if they had a band. Because James went into rehab and they didn't know if they were going to
get
together.
He was in an accident, right?
I don't know if it was an accident, but
he got burned or something wacky.
I think that happened, but I don't know if that was the same
thing. Oh, that wasn't the same thing?
This was, like, he went into rehab for whatever his issues were.
And right.
The band essentially was broken up.
Oh, okay.
And then they brought in a new bass, you know, like New State was kicked in. All this shit was going on. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought they were like, oh, I guess they don't want to do the deal with me.
Is your relationship mainly with the management of, and you don't get to interact too much with the other bands? Or do you know Metallica pretty well and Springsteen pretty well and Fish pretty well?
I don't hang out with band members. That's a general rule, with the exception of the Metallica Halloween party. Because I live in San Francisco, they have a Halloween party at their studio every year.
Right.
My daughter's been now with me four times.
They're carving
pumpkins with the band members' kids. But
cool.
Other than that, no, I'm not hanging out with the band members at all. I mean, like if they see, they would know me by sight.
Right.
They remember my name or not. But they know I'm the.
Okay.
They used to call me Hippie Brad because they knew I worked with Fish and the Dead. Okay. Yeah, a bunch of tatted up, you know,
nice.
All the Metallica dudes on the crew. And I was known as Hippie Brad.
Right.
But no, I'm not hanging out. And even Fish, who I've known the longest, you know, it's a wink and a nod and a hello. And I just try and
there's that guy we know belongs backstage, but we're not really quite sure
that's
why
exactly. And that is 100% by design.
Yeah.
I do not want to get in band members' faces. I don't want to be doing business in the aisles.
Right.
My relationship is professionally with band management,
right,
and their representatives, and occasionally their attorneys.
Yeah.
And I completely I'm not avoiding the band members.
No,
when summoned, I will go and speak with them about whatever. But you know,
it's pretty smart, I guess. I guess I was just wondering. I was just I'm fishing for good stories here.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, and if I had good stories, I probably wouldn't share. I wouldn't want to.
Darn it. Well, let me ask you a little bit more, and I know RJ has some questions, but a little bit digging into kind of the nuts and bolts of Nugs.net and your business and stuff. It's just a question that occurred to me. I understand how, you know, essentially computer servers can host a lot of music. So when you go with Live Fish and you buy a concert, you download it. I get it. But now when you talk about the webcasts and streaming, as you might know, I interviewed Ellie Tischberg, who's the director of the webcast, Fish Webcast.
So now
what they do, they film, you know, the Fish show, and their computers send that information, I'm thinking, to you, and you're the one that disseminates it to everybody. Is that right?
So the big change happened this year, actually on this, starting last night was the first night, and that big change is a full top-to-bottom upgrade to 4K. But just basically to talk about how it works is We started the webcast part of the business in 2010.
Okay.
Because the band on their own had decided August, it was the Greek shows in Berkeley. This was August or whatever, summer, end of summer tour 2010. The band brought out video.
We want to get some high quality audio and video into
the thing. We're going to start capturing. They were doing a 10 camera shoot every night in HD at the time. And they were just doing that. I didn't really know until I showed up in the video. I think they had mentioned it, but it wasn't part of the business. It was like, we're just going to do this to do it.
Right.
Just to have it in the can. And I think part of that, I'm making a leap of faith here, that maybe that came from Corin because DMB was very forward thinking and, starting in 2000.
It's smart archivally to do it.
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Anyway.
It's cheap enough now to do it. So after a couple months of doing that and, looking at the bill of what that was costing and not making any money from it, Colton called me up Thanksgiving weekend of 2010 and said, okay, we want to webcast the garden, figure it out.
There it is.
And, of course, once I saw the camera, I had been saying, hey, why aren't we doing this? Why don't we do archival? Why don't we do live? We kicked it around on Halloween. They weren't really ready to do it, weren't sure about the pricing. So it wasn't until Thanksgiving of 2010 that we got it ready for New Year's 2010.
It's also 2010 was kind of when the internet started growing up.
There was enough band. But keep in mind, we were doing just SD, standard def, 480 webcast back then because of bandwidth.
Oh, okay.
And so we were very conscious of, we didn't want to charge somebody's credit card and have it not work.
I see.
And we knew that our shit was going to work, but it's what's happening on the, and I knew this from my Cinema Now days. And just quick backstory, Cinema Now was the first company to license movies from every major studio. That was in 2000.
Right.
Our lead investors were Microsoft and Blockbuster. It was very ahead of, which sounds weird now, but back in 2000, Blockbuster was still the shit. And they were dominated the home video world.
Right.
And Microsoft was the biggest tech company. So I had that experience. I knew what it was like. I knew how every piece of the puzzle worked. I knew about live streaming because I had done Metallica from the North Pole in 95. I'd done the Grammys in 95 from the Shrine. I did Woodstock. I did countless events for Budweiser with NASCAR and all this stuff. So I'd done a gazillion webcasts. I knew how all the pieces fit together. But we still weren't sure in 2010 how the end user's experience would be because there's so many variables.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And even Netflix back then was just barely a streaming service. And keep in mind, and for all the people who file customer service tickets with us, when you tell us that, hey, my Netflix works, how come Live Fish doesn't? Netflix is on demand. So there's a huge difference in the topology of the internet with live and on demand, especially when it comes to HD video. The way the packets swarm apart and come back together and get to you, live is a whole different ballgame. When it's on demand, like your Netflix works because it's cached at a gazillion servers around the world closest to you. When it's live, it's coming live. And it's not cached anywhere.
Oh.
There's nothing to cache. So you're getting it directly from...
So that's not an apt comparison, the fact
that... When people... And look, I understand somebody pays $30 for...
I can watch Goodfellas really high quality. How come the live stream sucks?
I totally get it that somebody's pissed off. They paid money and it's not working.
Yeah.
But it's on your end. It's not on our end.
Well, on that topic.
And we do our best to solve it. And, I can guarantee you the shit's working. I can count on less than three fingers the times when I know it was a problem on our end.
Well, let me ask.
Halloween 2014.
Yeah.
And there's a couple, the shit storm in Chicago.
A couple of things happen. Yeah. Like things go down, of course.
Things go down at venues. So we've made huge effort over the years to have redundancy at the venues. At the end of the day, there's two things that are the bottlenecks, getting out of the venue and getting into your house.
Right.
Those are the two. Everything in between is generally fine. But
it's always the last mile and the first mile.
Yeah. So this summer, actually, we're made a big change and we're going satellite for most of the venues, except like the Gorge this weekend will be the first pay-per-views of the summer. We're bringing a satellite truck into the Gorge because we were at the Gorge of the Dead this summer. We've done a bunch of this.
Well, now that we have a Space Force, that's actually going to be more secure.
Right, exactly.
You mean set, and just so for people who don't understand the technology, so satellite versus...
Instead of using the venue internet
to get the video signal
out of... Which is wired. But...
you're going to park a truck next to...
We'll have a truck backstage at the Gorge, and most of the other shows this summer, with the exception of the Forum in LA, we know that's... The Forum and MSG are the two best venues in the world for bandwidth, so we know we're good there. But the other venues will have truck, so that means that a video signal, the high def signal, is leaving the venue, hitting a satellite, being pulled down to one of our NOCs in Salt Lake City. It's being encoded there on the fly and pushed directly out to Akamai, and then Akamai distributes it out to the world. So if anyone's having a problem at this summer's webcast,
blame Akamai. Just call Akamai.
No, I just
1-800-AKAMAI.
You know, it's unlikely, with the exception of like a power outage or a weather issue at the venue, it's right. unlikely that it's a live fish originated problem.
Okay.
So, and I get it. People have problems.
Right.
To
right.
make sure you're plugged in at home.
If shit doesn't work and it's your fault, you're going to make good somehow. They're going to get a free.
We try so hard about that. We give people codes.
But let me ask you from the other side. So not your fault. How about what happens and how do you handle people sharing passwords, for example?
So we've tried to be, and this is from day one with LiveFish, tried to be as liberal as possible while still being able to keep the lights on. You know, we need to, there's songwriters who need to be paid. There's band members who need to be paid. There's unions and venues that need to be paid.
Right.
There's, there's so many thumbs in the pie.
Right.
So it you know.
Piracy
there,
hurts.
There's a business there. Piracy hurts, but we're trying to be liberal with a fan base that has
like Netflix lets the entire family use one password.
So we we're not idiots. We know people randomly share passwords. We track that, and we can see who the egregious offenders are.
Oh, okay.
And there are policies in place to curtail it without being draconian in our.
Don't check my account. My account's fine.
Yeah.
I've never done it.
Mental note, check his account. So we're aware of that. And what's even more troubling than the password sharing is real-time restreaming, which, kind of came out of the gamer world of people essentially webcasting whatever game they're playing. So there's a lot of tools available now that Fish fans have embraced it really started to go crazy during the Baker's Dozen. I mean, we'd seen this bubbling up. It was 2016 is when Facebook Live went open to the public, and then YouTube turned. It used to be you needed to be like a sanctioned content provider to have access to the live broadcast tools on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, and now anybody can do it.
So essentially, Facebook Live and YouTube Live,
Twitch,
you can find things illegally rebroadcasted there
in real time.
In real time. Oh, I see.
That's the thing that's causing the biggest dent in our business.
Including games, like baseball games and stuff?
Right. So we had an interesting meeting at MLBAM, the company that runs MLB at Bat, and they run HBO Go.
Oh.
And we worked with them on the GD50 webcast. So, I don't think anybody has their shit together more than MLBAM. I mean, they're like an amazing company in what they do and how they do it. And Disney bought a big stake.
Right.
They're now building the Disney version of Netflix. They have their shit together in terms of live and on demand. And they have, rooms filled of engineers dealing with this kind of stuff. They said during the World Series, this past World Series, that they saw that they knew of some 20,000 separate illegal restreaming of the World Series.
So compared to 10 million who legitimately are watching, they're probably not worried about that.
Well, it's just interesting to see it's not like they need to fight to assert their copyright. It's obviously the World Series.
Oh, gotcha.
And it's owned by MLB.
Right.
Because what you have to do is you have to file DMCA takedowns with the different services you see it on. It's not like MLB couldn't prove that it was
correct.
For me, I have to prove that I have the rights to broadcast Fish content and that Fish is asserting their copyright. And there's a whole it's a massive pain in the butt.
I see.
And frankly, those services don't want you to take it down because they want to aggregate the eyeballs. And it's not like they're encouraging it. They're just not. Right. And
their advertisers are happy the more people that see it.
Right. They're
Whereas you guys are in the eyeball business. So to speak. Yeah.
They're in the eyeball business.
Yeah.
And, essentially you're the product.
Yeah.
You are the product on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and everything. Whereas my job is to represent, broadcast, disseminate, market, and protect the band's content.
Right.
So I'm caught in the middle. And there's certainly a segment of fans that have been very vocal in their hatred towards me, my family, my mother.
Stop it.
Nugs.net.
Really?
And people just going ballistic.
Nothing to hate here, folks. He's a nice dude.
There's copyright here, and certainly you as a songwriter, you got to understand. It's one thing with Napster blowing up, but now in the live video thing, people deserve to get paid for their work.
Right.
And we try. So to get back to your question, we try and be as fair as possible, but there's in the last year or so, we started using the YouTube Content ID service. So when people see why was my video taken down by Nugs.net? First of all, it's not us proactively doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of our workflow that every note that Fish plays live is submitted to YouTube's content ID system.
Right.
So that when there's illegal streams of full shows, it's flagged as a takedown.
But that only happens after the
fact. It happens after the fact because they don't do it in real time.
It can only be recognized.
We're trying to get them to do it in real time.
Oh, that would be amazing.
We're also trying it on Facebook. So I need to put it out there to fans who are listening.
Yes.
Like, we're not sitting in a room going after your handheld video of Possum from last night. This is part of our copyright enforcement that we were required to do to protect the songwriting, the performance, and then there's the PROs, BMI, and ASCA. The band would have to, if these things weren't protected, it would start costing a lot more money to do what we do. So the reason why you see these takedowns is we're trying to keep the service running.
Right.
You know, and we need to keep making money in order to keep it running.
Got it.
And it's not cheap to do what people think.
There's always a technology battle.
Yeah.
There's always when something amazing new comes out, there's a way to pirate it. And then it's the counter piracy. Mm-hmm.
But that always spurs innovation. So
right.
The thing that's really stifling innovation right now is not the technology, but it's the way that the songwriting is licensed, the way that the publishers are licensing for video.
Right.
That is our bit, for us at least, for Numbsnet, our biggest stumbling block is we're okay to do it live because there's no way we can license it ahead of time. It's not like we know what the band's going to play every night. And that goes for all of our bands, not just Fish.
Right.
So there's no practical way for us to license that. It's called a sync license
ahead
for video.
Time. Right.
And not to get too deep into the weeds, but with music, for an audio recording, we're in the clear. Nobody could stop us. Well, I mean, they could if they really wanted, but Congress has set a stat rate for mechanicals. And a mechanical means, the word mechanical actually comes from player pianos. So it was the first time that licensing sheet music for performance was a mechanical license. So a mechanical is like when you wrote the lyrics to X, Y, and Z Fish songs, there's a mechanical license attached to every download and CD we sell of any performance of that song, whether Fish performed or someone else. That's we're in the clear because Congress set a rate for that. It's totally straightforward. Same goes for audio streaming. There's a rate that's established. 10.5% of all of our streaming revenue goes back to the songwriters, split up pro rata based on what was played. Totally straightforward. Video, it's a complete shit show.
Yeah.
It's a total Wild West.
Sync, everything, bizarre stuff.
You need to get a sync. It's called a sync license. Yep. Where you synchronize an audio recording to a video reproduction.
Yeah.
So hopefully fans notice we added a video section to Live Fish, where we now have a couple shows. We have the Tahoe Tweezer.
Yeah.
We have that great show from Randall's. And there's a couple more in the can that we haven't released yet. So the band had to go and license any of the cover songs. Now, the Who Is She songs were essentially grandfathered licensed. Not like Who Is She is going to say, no, you can't put this up.
Right.
And Who Is She gets paid on that, and the cover songs get paid on that. But all those cover songs need to be licensed. You know, a great example, we did every night of Dead & Company as a pay-per-view. But they're only pay-per-views. They're not on demand because every song with Dead & Company is a cover. And some of them are Ice Nine. And then there's Dylan, Johnny Cash, Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
So we managed to work out a blanket license with Ice Nine for video, which is huge, huge step forward. But then we still have 30% of the other songs that we still haven't cleared yet. We can't make them on demand.
Right.
So that is stifling.
And every one of those could be a fight. Like it could be a Johnny Cash.
It's a battle.
Fight.
We're in the middle of it right now. And it's
that's amazing.
I sent Dylan's manager a version of Bobby doing Hard Rain's Gonna Fall out of space one night at Alpine. It was a great performance. And you know, they get it, they understand, but still it has to be licensed every time. We need to go to, like with Fish, if they play Peaches, we need to go to the Zappa estate. If they do, Zeppelin is just a flat out no in most cases.
You know,
because all the three living band members need to agree to grant the license. And when are you gonna get, you're gonna get three Zeppelin members together to listen to or to watch a Fish performance in Good Times, Bad Times? It's just not gonna happen. The first Fish video we did was a download from MSG 97, or was one of the first. We did video downloads about 10 years ago, and we had to cut out the Good Times, Bad Times. By the time fans didn't understand it, like, well, this, it's not like we don't want you to have it.
Right.
It's that Led Zeppelin doesn't wanna give us the time of day to grant the license to.
So those things should have a default on, you know what I mean? Like, if the three band members get together, yeah, exactly.
Well,
if we members get together and decide they don't like that version, then that's taken down.
Well, we have to operate in the good graces of the music publishers.
Yes, I know.
And that's something that's been a great learning experience for me working with fish is the way that they treat copyright, because you know they do a shitload of covers and the years, all the Halloween shows they release, all that stuff.
They so work they really hard doing
they
this
have stuff. A very you gotta credit Beth, gotta give a shout out to Beth. She has a phenomenal relationship with the licensing departments of all these music publishers.
Yep.
And so she has been like the mentor to me on how to do and how not to do music licensing.
Right.
And she's usually the one who's correcting the music publishers and the Harry Foxes of the world, because they've got their shit fucked up and they come to her to say, hey, is this the right? So it's a mess. I mean, for the longest time, you're actually faxing data back and forth to these. At least now they accept email.
Yeah.
But it's, so there's a case where we get stifled by the legal side.
Gotcha.
So two quick specific fish related questions. One is, you talked about, I mean, Tom mentioned that obviously NugsNet powers livefish.com, and there's archival releases and webcast schedules. Like you mentioned, I Saw It Again package, which just came out yesterday, which has, I think, 16 shows this summer.
Yep, it's all the weekends.
All the weekend runs, including Curveball and Dicks.
And
right?
Dicks, yeah. Do you the first time we've done that with fish, and putting ahead of time, hey, here's the season pass.
Yeah, well, we've been watching the webcast schedule closely, and I was assuming that nothing was happening this weekend, because it was like, I felt like it was a different sort of announcement, but which is great, and that's a ton of shows to put out there. Do you have input on that stuff? Like, do you guys strategize about it? Do you pitch ideas, or is it mostly like you guys just provide the infrastructure to get things out there once the band and management make decisions?
Yeah, basically when we see the routing of the tour, we get to work and we look, because there's a huge amount of legwork that goes into advancing the webcast, primarily around the bandwidth. I mean, there's the bandwidth, the union fees, the whatever. Yeah. So we'll look at
people
the schedule.
Don't really realize that.
No, there's a lot of work, and that does fall on us with the assistance of the band, of course, and there's just a general vibe like, look, summertime weekends are going to do better. So we should shoot for all the weekends unless there's some practical reason why we can't. So that's usually the first thought. Mm-hmm. And there's some back and forth between me and Colton and Micah, who's out on the road, who knows the venues, knows the IT guys at the venues. And I mentioned the satellite thing. This came out of, we literally just came off of Dead Tour. So we played half the same sheds and we know where it's going to be fucked up and where it's not. And so we decided to, we couldn't do it with the Dead because we didn't have enough lead time.
Yeah.
We only knew Alpine, so we had a satellite at Alpine Valley.
Yeah.
So by the time we came around to Fish Tour, we knew, okay, we're going to go to the Gorge with a truck, we're going to bring a truck to Alpharetta, we're going to, you know, just to hedge our bets to make sure, and again, this is to make sure that it's the best possible customer experience. We understand that if you're shelling out 30, like, you want it to work.
Yeah.
Clearly it has to work. But there's so much that happens in between the stage and your couch, that most of which we have no control over.
Yeah.
But we're the ones charging your credit card, so we're obligated to do everything we can to make it work.
Will the trucks have a big nugs.net banner on them? Because people might form a line behind it thinking they're selling something else.
No. Well, right.
But I'll be looking for the truck, the big satellite dish on top, and come and say hi to Brad at the truck.
It's not that big. It won't be in the truck. It's basically, it's local providers.
No, that's cool.
We're
that's
not
really
a
cool.
Truck around the
I mean, people have been for 15 or more years used to any newsworthy event seeing satellite trucks there.
But it really wasn't until this summer that the cost came down enough to make it practical.
Okay.
In previous years, we brought around a satellite dish that we had in a little road case, but it was just so shitty. I mean, like the service was all over the map, literally, in terms of and the amount of time that we spent aligning the dish.
Yeah, finding the satellite. Yeah.
It was just a nightmare. So we abandoned that, just went to a regular satellite dish. And there are other things. There's like backpacks that aggregate cell phones, but like that's just unreliable. We can't. And again, it goes back to the fact that we're charging money for fans to watch the show. We need to do everything that's commercially viable to make it work. And so that's how we got to this. Now, when we get into the fall, those indoor arenas are generally more reliable. Certainly MGM is great. MSG is great. I say this, we'll probably crash at both those venues, but it's,
Do you notice anything with regard to data of who subscribes and who watches, West Coast versus East Coast, just given the time difference?
Yeah, we generally see a fall off in the audience of about a third for West Coast shows.
Okay. And is that of the amount of people that subscribe?
Amount of people who pay.
Okay.
Subscribers is different, because if you subscribe, you're getting all the audio recordings.
Okay. Gotcha. And so the people that pay specifically for the webcast, it's one third less for the West Coast, just knowing they're going to be asleep.
So when we do Halloween in Vegas, for example, it's great that it's Halloween in Vegas, but it's not as big of a a pay-per-view event just naturally because of the time zone.
And it's in the middle of the week.
When it's Halloween in Atlantic City, it's
a little different.
You know, it's great. Yeah. You get the whole country doing it.
Right.
So that does factor in for sure.
Gotcha.
And that goes into our decision when we look at the schedule as well of what, you know, what shows
right
to do. Yeah, the dozen, that was the first time that we did an entire stretch of shows as one pass.
Right.
I think we had also did Chicago that summer, some other things, but
right.
That was kind of the genesis to the I Saw It Again pass we're doing now.
Gotcha.
We saw the Baker's Dozen, we're like, okay, right. Why aren't we doing
now
this?
Now we can
this
do
summer?
This package thing.
So it was a good, you know, New Year's we do really well, the Four Nights at the Garden. Those, as you could imagine, you could look at the Phish calendar and guess at what are going to be the big events.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tuesday night in Alpharetta, maybe not. I mean, this time it's a weekend. But,
right.
I also should mention there'll be a couple surprises this summer of free streams that we haven't announced yet.
Not necessarily Phish shows.
No, Phish shows. free stream. We'll be streaming from your living room. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Just a free stream, but yeah. We're not sure what's going to be on there.
Before I forget, the 4K thing. So this summer we upgraded all the gear to 4K. The pay-per-views are still 1080 because there's some concern about how we get, again, we don't want to charge money for something that's it's not going to work for
somebody. Right, of course.
So our goal is to do Curveball as a 4K, we'll a separate package because we already have this stuff on sale.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we'll credit people who've already bought Curveball if they want the 4K, but we'll come up with a 4K package for Curveball that will hopefully be our first actual pay-per-view live in 4K.
In 4K, amazing. And when are you going 3D? I've heard rumors.
Yeah, I get approached every day about that.
Really?
So especially being in San Francisco.
Really?
I'm curious what you think about, you want to sit on your couch with goggles on and watch Phish?
There's probably people that do.
Probably people that do. Maybe if we pair it with the weed delivery and doorbell rings 15 minutes before each set, and that could be great, but I don't know. I'm not so. I haven't seen it done well.
Well, you also have to see the audience, right? You have to see the business that you're in. You have to see the audience first before you go after it.
But there's also, we put so much time, effort, and money into making it sound good and look good.
Right.
I don't want it bastardized just for the bells and whistles effect of 3D. I'm into the concept.
Oh, come on. It's better, dude.
Yeah. I'm not ruling it out. I mean, maybe we'll have Phish 3D next year.
Yeah.
That Phish 3D movie was a huge success, right? So I'm sure we'll go.
I don't know if it was or it wasn't.
So Brian, my colleague Matt, who does the Helping Friendly podcast with me, he had a specific question for the audio nerds out there. Who's mixing Phish recordings now? Because Matt's, or I think our impression was that Altschuler is working with Springsteen,
yeah.
But Gary's does the audio. Like, who's doing the mixing for?
It's Gary. So
it is Gary.
Gary, who's mixing for, Gary took over for Paul. So initially, the quick backstory is we launched Live Phish 2002. Paul was still mixing the band. They were Paul's recordings directly to fans. That's what we launched with at the beginning of Live Phish. Then when the band came back, Hampton, 2009, we brought out a truck to mix those three shows. So we gave the recordings out for free as a welcome back thing.
Right.
So my impression is having done that with the truck, it kind of, because Paul wasn't there anymore. So it was like, okay, well, we mixed multi-track for Hampton. Why wouldn't we do it? So we did that first summer, just going front of house. And then by the fall tour, we brought out another guy who was doing mixes and then finally got Altschuler into place. And that was great. So we did many, many years with Chiller mixing it. And then I think, the band just decided, hey, look, we want it to sound like what's coming out of the PA.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for them, but that was the vibe I got. And it was, everyone loves Chiller. It was not, And it was a happy coincidence that it was the same time that I brought him into the Springsteen world and they loved him. And that happened at the same time. He didn't leave Phish because of Springsteen. Mm-hmm. It was just so happened it was around the same time that actually would have been a lot more convenient to me if he had. We had Bruce on tour that time and we had to wait. But
who's the new guy for Phish?
So it's not a new guy. It's just Gary. Gary's mixes are what's being released.
Gotcha.
Brad, can I ask you quickly just about sort of the future of NugsNet? It seems like you're moving from, you started as we talked about being a sort of service provider, and you've moved over the years to being more involved with content creation and content distribution. And as streaming is becoming more popular and downloads and obviously other music, mediums are, it seems like streaming and the stuff that you're doing is becoming more prominent. Do you see NugsNet moving in that direction of creating more content, being more involved with the distribution and the creation than just being a sort of service provider?
I think it's all of the above, and one kind of feeds into the other. So the biggest eye-opener for us recently was the show we did on MTV Live called The Live Stash. So mm-hmm. I've been hosting a show on Sirius for 10 years called The Weekly Live Stash mm-hmm. that's on Jam On every mm-hmm. weekend. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's been great promotion. That's been fun. It's like the highlight of my week every week is mm-hmm. to record that show. And then we just kind of took that name, The Live Stash, and put it on MTV and did an 8-episode series of video. And the exposure we got just from being on the channel guide, and it's kind of just the thrill of seeing Nugsnet on your Comcast channel guide. That was cool. But we got tremendous feedback from that. So that was really a great eye-opener of like, okay, we're amassing all this content. Let's create a pipeline to put it out across mm-hmm. different mm-hmm. channels, mm-hmm. whether it's OTT or traditional cable, certainly satellite radio we've already been doing. You know, at this point, we're programming 4 of the biggest branded channels on Sirius. I mean, not handing them content for the programmers. Right. You know, the live shows each of these bands play, being Pearl Jam, Bruce, Fish, and the Dead. So it's... But one feeds the other. Mm-hmm. So we're out there harvesting the content on some level. The bands do the production. It's their audio. It's their video. Yeah. It's their lights. Their right. stage. It's their music. They license that music to us. And it's my job to figure out creative ways to get that music out to fans yep. so that the band can get paid.
Right.
So that's how we've created this nice ecosystem in a world where people aren't buying downloads anymore. They stop buying CDs. Everybody's moving to a streaming world. It's subscription-based where artists get paid less. That maybe there's a long tail, but they're going to get paid less in the short term. So we've built this mousetrap, and you know, probably the best thing is the ticket scanning with Fish. Mm-hmm. That concept of scan your ticket and it's going to unlock the stream of tonight's show. And we just did that with the Dead this summer. That to me is the ultimate mousetrap. And that's the thing that makes, you know, Ticketmaster and Live Nation's eyes pop out of their head. And we're like, we're getting the ticket holder, not the ticket buyer, mm-hmm. to come back to your store
yeah.
and spend more money on other shit.
That's incredible.
It's like, yeah. that's the ultimate, yeah. like knowing who's at the show, getting them to come back. Right. And putting more stuff in front of them because they're your super fan.
How many people of like a 20,000, you know, arena actually do go ahead and scan to get that night show?
I would say the highest has been like 55%, and on average it's about 30-some%.
More than half?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I mean, something like Curveball, I bet, will be about half. But on average, it's about a third.
That's
but
amazing.
If you think about it, it's one dude going to the show with his 3 friends, so it makes sense because they don't all need to
yes.
get, you know, everybody yeah. gets...
Right.
And we used to get something else I should explain. We used to give away the download.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then we switched to stream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason was because we were following user behavior. It wasn't that we were trying to take something away from
right.
fans.
Right.
It was that everybody was streaming and nobody was downloading the thing. So why are we... And then there's a whole trickle
down. It does
down.
Make you do a $10 a month subscription.
You don't need to subscribe. No. You scan your ticket in the app. You do not need to be a subscriber. You need to have a LiveFish account.
Oh, okay.
But just you don't need to be a subscriber.
Oh.
You can listen to just because it's added to your stash.
And basically, you're streaming it at that point.
Yeah.
You don't own it.
You have you have unlimited access to it.
For, okay.
You know, as long as you have a LiveFish account.
Okay. Awesome. That's good to clarify that.
And a lot of that is because of the light. There's a trickle down of the licensing because you know the cost of the mechanicals.
Yeah.
We're already paying that cost for the streaming service.
Yeah. Makes sense.
But it was really a natural progression anyway because you want it in your car, you want it at home, you want it on your Sonos, you get like all this stuff.
Yep.
Good stuff. Good stuff, Brad. Well, you've definitely illuminated and answered some of my questions. And RJ, are we good? Anything else going on?
Well, I just want to say, just to sort of reiterate what we were talking about earlier, I hope people listening understand that, you know, the stuff that Brad's doing and that Nugs provides for all of us as fans comes from a place of wanting to provide fans with awesome content and as high quality content as possible. So go easy on Nugsnet and Brad, because you're obviously doing this from a place of passion and caring about the music, which I think is an important takeaway.
Well, that's a good, just one last thing on the hi-fi audio. So that was from day one, when I went to that meeting with Elektra and Warner Brothers, I insisted that it was going to be no DRM and that we would have a lossless component. And that was unheard of back in 2001, whenever that meeting was, to not have DRM and to have a true CD quality. And now that CD quality has been up to higher than CD quality with 24-bit audio, that is a driving principle of everything we do. It has to sound as good as technology will allow.
I thought it
sounded great out there last night, by the way. Kudos to Gary. It really sounded great because, like, you know, sometimes I don't notice it if I'm sitting in a trailer backstage when I get to go out and hear it.
Yeah.
Nice. Really, well, thanks so much, Brad, for coming here, and have a great show, second show tonight at Lake Tahoe.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, RJ.
Yeah.
All right. Osiris. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. OSIRIS is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at OSIRISPod.com.